Everybody want to stand up this time. Everybody must stand up because we's all Americans and so forth and so on. We are Americans. I'd like to do the American anthem the way it really is in the air, what you breathe every day, the way it really sounds.
Jimi Hendrix playing the American National Anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, at Berklee Community Center in 1970, one of the last performances of his life. Americans have pretty strong feelings about the Star-Spangled Banner. It's emotional, powerful, regarded with reverence by some and suspicion by others. I'm Erica Wagner, and I'm an author, journalist, and I suppose I'm a Londoner. I've lived in London for the last 25 years, but I'm a New Yorker by birth, and so, for the BBC World Service, I'm exploring from the outside and inside America's relationship with its national anthem.
It's unusual for a national anthem to refer to an item. In our case, it is the flag. So the flag has truly become the national symbol.
It's the whole idea that we've come to the brink and that the symbol of our nation continues to fly. In a lot of ways, it's a hymn.
Our flag was still there, a big deal.
Hendrix's rendition caused a huge stir. At his most famous performance at Woodstock, the distortion of his electric guitar, the feedback from the amplifiers, was likened to the sounds of bombs and jet aircraft and interpreted as a critique of American involvement in the Vietnam War. At the time of this performance, the Star-Spangled Banner had been America's official anthem for fewer than 40 years, yet already it was so much embedded in American national identity that Hendrix was seen to be making a very controversial, even un-American, political statement.
It didn't become the official national anthem until 1931.
Mark Leibson is a historian and journalist.
It was one of a handful of patriotic airs that were played at patriotic events all throughout the 19th century. During the Civil War, we never had an official national anthem. The Battle Hymn of the Republic was a de facto national anthem. In the 1880s and 1890s, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy adopted the Star-Spangled Banner as their anthem, and that made it more popular. And as we got into the 20th century, a movement grew up to make it the national anthem.
Dr. David Hildebrand is a scholar and performer of early American music, teaching at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore.
Back in the 19-teens and 20s, when Congress were dealing with this issue of what do we make official, Hail Columbia, the Star-Spangled Banner, Yankee Doodle, and My Country, 'Tis of Thee. The closest contender is Hail Columbia. Yankee Doodle, of course, would never be a real contender for the national anthem. It's too low class.
To understand the appeal of the Star-Spangled Banner, now almost exactly two centuries old, I went to find its beginnings in Maryland.
It's a warm and windy day here at Fort McHenry in Baltimore, and I'm about to talk to Scott Sheeds, who is a historian and a ranger here.
How long have you worked at the site?
I've been historian, park ranger here at Fort McHenry for about 32 years now.
Oh, wow.
Fort McHenry sits out on a point of land, a peninsula, about a mile long, south of Baltimore, and it moves out into the Patapsco River. The War of 1812 culminates here.
The story of the anthem begins during the Battle of Baltimore in 1814, part of the War of 1812, or America's Second War of Independence. It's certainly a much less well-known conflict than what we think of as the War of Independence some 30 years before. It would take both wars to completely sever ties from Britain.
The war was begun with England after 2 decades of British interference with our free trade and the rights of American seamen at sea. Now, Baltimore, by the War of 1812, is the third largest city in the United States. And this is where all the warehouses are, tobacco warehouses, shipbuilding. And so the war culminates here in September of 1814.
So what happened here at Fort McHenry was a pivotal moment in the history of the United States.
Yes, it was. You know, the War of 1812 is a dark affair for the United States. And all of a sudden, here in Baltimore, there's an uplift of morale with the American victory. And soon after this, there's a new song published here in Baltimore. It's called The Star-Spangled Banner, written by a young American named Francis Scott Key, who was held on board a small American ship about 3 miles from here, watching the battle.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proud
So can you point out in the harbor where Francis Scott Key would have been?
So as we're looking now southward, Francis Scott Key's vessel was anchored with the bombardment fleet of about 20 warships. He was anchored just to the left of the river out here, out of range, but he clearly had a view of the fort and especially of the flag that September morning. For the first time, someone, Key, puts down on paper what that flag meant to the Americans. No one had ever done that before. It gave the Americans a new American identity.
The flag itself is now housed at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
The flag that we're standing in front of is the flag that the national anthem of the United States was written about. The Star-Spangled Banner is actually one of the most significant icons. It was the Second War for Independence. It was the one that established the United States as being a viable country, and that has certainly been a foundation of what Americans think of as American identity.
Suzanne Thomason-Krause is a conservator at the museum.
I think what's different in this exhibit than any other exhibit in the building is people have a sense of respect and reverence when they come in, and you can tell that people quiet down and they take their time. They think about what the anthem that's displayed behind it means to them. It's unusual for a national anthem to refer to an item rather than the country. So if you think about all the others, it's the monarchy, it's the country, it's the national heritage. In our case, it is the flag. So the flag has truly become the national symbol. So it's a very unique way for people to get in touch with who they are as an American.
Anytime you see the American flag, it brings you pride.
Overwhelmed at the history behind what it represents.
I don't know if it's just the anthem, but it's a part of history that really put us in position to be a free country.
Well, I couldn't believe they still got it from so long ago when they wrote the Star-Spangled Banner.
Walk along any street in America, and you'll find it's impossible to avoid the Stars and Stripes. The flag flies on private houses, federal buildings, shopping malls. It's one of the first things I notice when I go back to the United States. The flag is everywhere, and there's a real pride in our national symbol.
Americans have a unique feeling for our flag.
The historian Mark Leepson, who is the author of Flag, an American biography.
We have the Pledge of Allegiance. American school children pledge allegiance to their flag every day, and the U.S. House and Senate do it before they start. We have the Star-Spangled Banner. The National March of the United States is the song The Stars and Stripes Forever by John Philip Sousa. We have the Flag Day holiday, June 14th. We have the U.S. Flag Code, part of the Federal Code of the United States. Given this unique feeling, what I found interesting in the history of the flag is that for the first third of our history, we didn't have this feeling. Really, it was almost unheard of for individual Americans to fly the flag. It was mostly flown by the government, mostly by the military, and mostly by the Navy as a signaling and communications device. This changed 180 degrees in 1861 when the Civil War began. Virtually overnight, they started appearing in front of people's houses, schools, and so on. And this is the beginning of what some have called the cult of the flag, this almost religious feeling that Americans have for this flag. Now, of course, it was only in the northern states. The southern states had their own flag. But the cult of the flag spread nationwide in the last two decades of the 19th century.
The Battle of Baltimore took place in what year?
1814.
Very good. Let's roll another strike.
We're standing here looking at a replica of the original flag that flew over Fort McHenry. It's absolutely enormous. It's being held up by a crowd of tourists. There are about 20 tourists all along the long side of the flag, and another 10 or 15 along its shorter side. So that gives you an idea of what an immense piece of cloth it really is.
At the busy corner of Albemarle Street in Baltimore, I met Amanda Davis, curator of the Star-Spangled Banner Flag House, the home of Mary Pickersgill, who made this enormous flag for Fort McHenry.
The best way to start is to look back at our flag window. Our flag window is the 30 by 42 feet of the Star-Spangled Banner that Mary Pickersgill made. Red and white stripes, 15 stars, 15 stripes. And 30 by 42 feet is a huge, huge flag, huge flag. And George Armistead, who's the commander at Fort McHenry, is known for having this flag commissioned so that it is visible to the British fleet. Watch your step down.
These are actually quite small rooms. You wouldn't have the space to make an enormous flag like this here.
Exactly, 30 by 42 foot flag would not have fit. Mary has a lot of connections here in the neighborhood. So a friend of hers, Mr. Brown, who owns a brewery just a block away, lends his malt house floor so that she can spread it out and finish stitching the stripes and place all 15 stars.
You're listening to Oh Say Can You See with me, Erica Wagner, here on the BBC World Service. Today, flags are still a thriving business in America. Annan Flagmakers, founded in 1847, is the oldest flag-making company in the country. Ronnie Coble is sewing manager in Annan's South Boston factory in Virginia.
This is the fabric. This fabric is woven in North Carolina. It comes to us, and we dye it on these dye machines. The roll of fabrics come to our slitting machine. Then the next process, we start sewing the stripes back together. On our smaller flags, we embroider the stars, and then the larger are applique fields. And we do those right here at Annan. We have a heat press to be sure the stars are laying flat. The next step would be to take it to a sewing machine, a zigzag stitch, and sew them down.
This is what I do.
Patricia Russell is one of the workers.
I will sew it all the way around these so it will stay on. And then I will turn it over and I check the back. Seldom that we mess up that we can't fix. Very seldom.
And flag and song always go hand in hand.
Yes, Yes, I know the Star-Spangled Banner. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we...
These lines that Francis Scott Key wrote that night have become maybe the most repeated lines in American history.
Mark Leibson, who's also written a biography of Francis Scott Key.
virtually all Americans know one thing about him, that he wrote the Star Spangled Banner, but hardly anyone knows about his life. He was a 35-year-old lawyer in Washington, D.C., and from a very prominent family in Maryland. He was an amateur poet. His poetry was never meant to go beyond family and friends, which is a good thing, because if you read his poetry, it is very amateur, with the exception of this one poem.
Mary Jo Salter is a critically acclaimed poet and is a professor in the Writing Seminars program at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where we met. I began by asking her how good a poet Francis Scott Key really was.
Not too good. He wrote, I think, a beautiful first stanza of a poem that turned into a national anthem, and I love it. But if you keep reading one stanza after another, you realize that he didn't need to keep going.
But let's talk about the poem as a work of literature. How does it stand up?
The rhyme scheme alternates, and then it turns into couplets. It's A, B, A, B, C, C, D, D. What that means is that you're moving from matching sounds that are farther away to sounds that are closer together. It's becoming more conclusive and stirring. Also, in O Say Can You See, which is the most famous line, those big vowels, O Say Can You See, and O Say Does That Star-Spangled Banner Yet Wave, those big vowel sounds are very singable and very stirring. To some degree, he must have known exactly what he was doing, and yet if we look at the other stanzas, we begin to get rhymes like confusion and pollution, and they don't sing as well.
Mark Leibson.
There's a question, there had been a question of, was he writing a song or was he writing a poem that night? And that's the way people had it, that since he was an amateur poet, he was writing a poem, and somehow it got put to a famous tune of the time. What he wrote, those four verses were in rhyme and meter, totally compatibly with this song, To Anacreon in Heaven, which was very popular at the time. And it's almost certain that he had that in mind when he was writing that song.
To Anacreon in Heaven, where he sat in full glee, a few sons of harmony sent a petition.
To Anacreon in Heaven was originally an English tune. It was composed by John Stafford Smith for a gentleman's club called the Anacreontic Society in London. The early American music scholar, David Hildebrand.
I'm almost evangelical about insisting that people stop referring to it as a poem. He knew that tune very well. First of all, he had already written a song to the same melody 9 years before, When the Warrior Returns. In 1798, there was an American parody of it called Atoms and Liberty, and that was a big hit.
Should the tempests of war overshadow our land, its bolts could not rend freedom's temple asunder. For unmoved at the portal would George Washington stand and repulse with his breast the assaults of the thunder.
In every melody, there's a contour. There's dramatic development. And when you pick which word you're going to use on the highest note, that matters. When you write new words to a pre-existing tune, the melody needs to make certain adjustments. So it didn't start like this. It started, To Anacreon in heaven, where he sat in full glee. Now, first of all, that's kind of odd, isn't it? Da, 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 we're used to. And it's the organist here in Baltimore in 1814 who's the first person to change to make that F sharp the normal way we think of it today. The other big change wasn't standardized for over 100 years, and that's the idea of coming down from the top, oh, say, because you can find publications in the 1920s and 1930s of the piece starting at the bottom.
And recordings. This is from the 1920s.
The Star-Spangled Banner. by the Edison Military Band.
The piece clearly had a lilt. It's in 3/4 time. Yup, but dun 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 one two dun dun. I think it's much more the focus on performers that's really changed the song considerably from how it was 200 years ago. There are a lot of performers today who like to hear their own voices so much that they add an extra beat into every measure. And so they do it in 4/4 time. Oh, say, can you see how great is my voice? That sort of thing.
What so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming.
The Star Spangled Banner has acquired the reputation of being difficult to sing. Personally, I couldn't disagree. Its 1.5 octave range has caught out performers from Christina Aguilera to Steven Tyler. That said, in impeccable voice and 4/4 time, you've just heard Beyoncé, Jennifer Hudson, and Mark Anthony. Last of all was one of the most acclaimed renditions of the anthem, Whitney Houston at the Super Bowl, the pinnacle of the American football season, in 1991. The poet Mary Jo Salter.
I think that there are certain words that get us every time, words like proudly, gallantly. And it's interesting, I think, especially for those who don't primarily think of themselves as patriots, don't get all worked up about nationalistic agendas, and even a total pacifist, I think, can be moved by, and the rocket's red glare, the bomb bursting in air.
As with many performances of the anthem at major sporting events, Whitney Houston's was closely associated with the American military. It was followed by a flyover of F-16 jet fighter aircraft.
There is something about the extremity of what's happening and the emotions that are called up by those acts that make you want to go out and do something. And that's actually something scary about propaganda. He wasn't writing as a propagandist. He was writing as a stirred American. But at the same time, you know, we're aware that words can be used to fight battles we don't want to fight, and yet the heart beats anyway.
Kevin Blackistone is a sports journalist and visiting professor of journalism at the University of Maryland.
You are hard pressed to go to an organized sporting event, certainly professional, in college, but maybe even high school and middle school, where the national anthem does not signal the beginning of the game. In this particular song, in this piece of religiosity in American life, I think in some ways does a disservice to those who serve in military conflict. There is a danger in commercialized patriotism, and it all begins with the Star Spangled Banner.
In coming to represent American patriotism, the anthem has also become a focus for political dissent. Some athletes have even refused to sing it before games, particularly in times of war. But the meaning of the Star Spangled Banner isn't so easily pinned down. In her short story, The Juniper Tree, the acclaimed American writer Lori Moore, reading here, has her narrator sing the anthem as a tribute to a deceased friend.
I knew that if you took the Star Spangled Banner very slowly and mournfully, it altered not just the attitude of the song, but the actual punctuation, turning it into a protest and a question. I sang it slowly. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
The Star-Spangled Banner was born in war and has always been closely associated with the U.S. military. But the way it is sung today sounds nothing like the marching rhythm of the song in 1814. As an American who has lived in Britain for the last 25 years, I still find myself stirred by both the music and the words. America is a nation united by a symbol, our flag. So a hymn to the Stars and Stripes is fitting, and we can reflect both on how the anthem came about and how we choose to perform it now, in praise or in protest. So we return to Jimi Hendrix, this time at Woodstock. Oh, Say Can You See was presented by me, Erica Wagner. The producer was Philippa Gearing, and it was a unique production for the BBC World Service.